Do you have student loans? Are you worried about making your payments? Don't worry, we can help you. If you're behind, if you're late, or even if you're in default on your student loans, we can help you consolidate your student loans into one affordable monthly payment and cut your payments right away. We provide student loan relief, getting you relief for your student loans fast, no matter how much you owe or how far behind you are on your payments. Call our established student toll-free assistance line now at 1-877-658-7153. We can fix your student loan problems guaranteed. Call 1-877-658-7153 now. We've helped thousands of people just like you fix their student loans. Our specialists are waiting for your call. Call 1-877-658-7153. That's 1-877-658-7153. Again, 1-877-658-7153.
You're listening to the Right Stream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Right Stream and hashtag Right Stream. Thanks for listening to the Right Stream Radio Network.
Good evening from the beautiful Florida Space Coast, everyone. This is your host, Daria Ann, broadcasting this Right Stream Tuesday at a special time of 9 p.m. Eastern. I am also the founder of the Right Stream Radio Network here on Blog Talk Radio, and I want to thank you so much for joining us at this special time. And I'm really psyched about tonight's guest. Just can't wait to start this interview. But before we get to that, I just want to take a couple of minutes to just kind of apprise you all of what's been going on here at the Right Stream Radio Network. First of all, we are undergoing a total transformation of our website thanks to the very talented Alan Scott, a.k.a. Snapperhead, who is this awesome web developer and SEO expert. And he's helping us out with this redesign, which we are hoping is just going to help us take the network to the next level. We're gearing up for a collaborative marketing venture in the next couple of months, which I'm thrilled about. And we got some other plans scheduled down the road here, a little bit down the road, hopefully in the second quarter, that I'm not quite at liberty to discuss yet. But our director of marketing, Lisa Tarvez, and I have been very busy working on RightStream and just, as I said, just sort of getting us to the next level, hitting our goals this year for 2015. And we're really excited. 2 years later, we're really moving ahead. Our second anniversary actually is coming up on March 3rd. And we're just really thrilled with our progress, including the fact that we are now a seven-day-a-week network with the addition of Get Fit, Feel Fabulous with Brit, which debuted last Saturday, Valentine's Day, and Brit will air every Saturday at 10 a.m. Eastern. And, of course, Fantasy Dating Radio, which made its debut last month, and that airs every Wednesday night at 9 p.m. Eastern with the fabulous Suzanne and Rob. Those two are just really... You know, if you haven't listened to the archives of their show, go to blogtalkradio.com/rightstream because Suzanne and Rob are really making it happen. So excited to have them on the network. And, of course, we have Military Monday with John D. Gresham. If you missed this week's broadcast about World War I, it was a fascinating interview. John always produces an excellent show, but for some reason this one was a standout this week, even better than his usual high quality. So check that out in the archives, but listen to Military Monday every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern. And, of course, Sundays at 7 p.m. Eastern, we have Just Believe with the beautiful Lisa Tarvez coming at you at 7 p.m. And, of course, all times are Eastern, so I'll stop repeating myself there. And, of course, Tuesday, I normally broadcast at 1 p.m. Eastern, but my guest tonight is so special, and he lives out in California. And I said, absolutely, I will be more than happy to accommodate your schedule. So that is why we are broadcasting at 9 p.m. Eastern. And I promise I'm going to get to that interview here in just a moment. Thursdays, we have Love, Liberty, and Lip Gloss, 7 p.m., hosted by Lisa Tarvez and me. And that's our women's lifestyle show. And we talk about all kinds of topics, from the very serious to sort of the fun and frivolous and everything in between that is of interest to women. And we are going to be talking with an author this week, Michelle Hasty Thompson, who's the author of a book called Weight Loss Shift. So that should be a lot of fun, so I hope you can tune in this Thursday for that. And every Friday at 6 p.m., we have the best-selling author, S. Evan Townsend, hosting the Speculative Fiction Cantina, where they discuss all things weird and wonderful in the world of books and writers. It's your weekly hypodermic injection of science fiction, fantasy, paranormal, and as I said, all kinds of weird and wonderful things. We're just thrilled that Evan was able to join us last October. He joined the network, and he's also doing just a fantastic job. So check us out at our home at blogtalkradio.com/writestream. We do have a website up, writestreamradio.com. That is not what it's going to look like when the final product is ready, but you certainly can go there to get all the information you need about our hosts and lineup. One other thing I want to mention real quickly is that I am also a writer for American Journal, the-american-journal.com, and Snapperhead, my good buddy Alan Scott, web designer, is also the proprietor of that fabulous website, so please check that out. All right, well, as many of you know, I love to bring on guests from the Conservative Libertarian Fiction Alliance on Facebook. It's just a fantastic group of talented, independent-minded authors and readers as well. We have a lot of readers that are in there and really just a lot of creative talent. A lot of these people cross over and do many, many things in many creative endeavors, such as graphic design. And I'll tell you, I'm just blown away by the amount of talent that's in that group. And my guest tonight, of course, is no exception. You may also recognize his voice from the right-wing riot, the Prince of White Bread. But actually, his real name is Roy M. Griffiths, and he has another great book out called The Big Bang, The Lonesome George Chronicles, Book 1. And you may remember I did interview him, I believe it was last year, about his book By the Hands of Men. That's also a series. Griff is great. He writes series novels, and I'm just real excited. We'll delve into a lot of that this evening. And if you want to ask him any questions, please call in at 347-945-7246. But I'm going to tell you a little bit about Griff in his own words. He says he decided he wanted to be a writer when he was 10 years old, and he's never looked back. No matter what I did to pay the bills, and he says he's done a lot, he kept writing short stories, plays, poetry, novels, and screenplays. He's a member of the Writers Guild, an occasional contributor to PJ Media, which is Pajamas Media, for those of you who may not be familiar, and other conservative websites. He also writes and performs political satire with the Right-Wing Riot as the Prince of White Bread. And together with Scary Smart and Ms. Always Right, he also produces the Truesberry cartoon, which is phenomenal, and you can find that at rightwingriot.com. Griff is also very proud of the 8 years spent in the Coast Guard, where he was one of the first 65 U.S. Coast Guard aviation rescue swimmers in the country. Volume 2 of the Lonesome George Chronicles is nearly complete, and he's now preparing to release 2 more books in the By the Hands of Men series. He lives for now in Southern California with his family of writers, teachers, cats, and dogs. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, I want to introduce author Roy M. Griffiths. Hey, Roy. Griff.
Hey, Daria. Gosh, I sound much more impressive, I think, than I actually am when you read it. I'll have you do all my promos from now on.
All right. Well, thank you. That means a lot. I felt like I was babbling there for a moment. I always had, like, this surge of energy.
It was bad writing. The delivery was great. The writing was bad.
Well, no, welcome to the show. And I mean, Chris, my gosh, there's so much we have to talk about. But before we get started, let our listeners know, because you were just in New York for a very special occasion recently. And why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Let's see. Liberty Island Media, a.k.a. the new home of the conservative counterculture, had a launch party last week, last Wednesday. It had been postponed because of a big snowstorm late in January, and I was able to fly out there. And it was very fun. It was held on 44th, West 44th, and as this white boy from Nebraska is bumbling his way through Midtown trying to find this place, I discovered it was actually a stone's throw away from the Algonquin. That is the famous Algonquin Hotel with the round table from the 1920s all the New Yorker wits and barbed tongues used to hang out there drinking and saying witty, bitter things. It was a lot of fun because I finally had a chance to meet some people I've only corresponded with or spoken to over the phone. But at last I got a chance to meet Adam Bellow, who is the editor of Liberty Island and the guy who plucked the Big Bang from obscurity. I met the publisher, David Bernstein, both lovely people, and they had an open bar, which really sort of raised them in my esteem right there. And it was such a typical New York place, again, for this, you know, from where I came from, the Midwest, we didn't have places like this, but there wasn't really like a name on the outside of the building. It was just a number, and you go in, and there's like this club, and there's you know, beautiful people doing beautiful thing and drinking exotic drinks. And the Liberty Island people had a nice little, they had like a sunken little cubby alcove of their own next to their own private bar. And it was very fun. I also, what was even better was I finally had a chance to meet Ms. Always Right in the Mysterious and Luring Flesh, excuse me, as well as Scary Smart Jamie K. Wilson. So that was a real treat. And they made me get up on a table and say a few words and be my gracious, humble self before I raced back to the open bar. But what was really nice was I was expecting an older crowd, because that's almost sort of the typical image we have of conservatives. You know, they're all older, you know, older white Republicans. And in fact, there were a lot of younger people between 25 and 30, 30-year-olds, professional folks making their living in finance or in some cases the arts in New York City at this club, who identified strongly as conservatives. There were one or two people I think were there by mistake, but most of the folks I talked to, yeah, I'm a conservative. It was very interesting. It was very interesting.
Wow, that gives me a lot of hope. That is great to hear.
Well, my only concern was if somebody knew we were there, that single hand grenade, they could have wiped out all the Republicans in New York City at one time.
Because right.
There were like 100 of us packed into this little alcove. But it was great fun. And as I said, met all kinds of people. I met a young woman from California who's actually working for a British conservative magazine, and unfortunately I never got the full story, but I have her card. I just had to know, how did that happen? And I was unfortunately, it was also a loud bar, so you had to stand very close to people and sort of bellow to be heard, so it was hard to get in some of the nuance of how did you end up as a conservative sort of thing, which is always kind of interesting to me, is how we get where we are and how did we arrive at our particular set of beliefs. But, you know, I will follow up on that when I feel better.
Yes, and I want to thank you for joining me tonight in spite of your cold, Griff. I really appreciate that so much. So we shall soldier on here. And before we start talking, because I'm looking forward to talking about The Big Bang, The Lonesome George Chronicles, Book 1, which has gotten rave reviews. Before we get to that, though, I kind of want to back up a little bit and ask you, what was it that happened when you were 10 that convinced you to pursue writing as a career?
Let's see. Broken home, you know, poor upbringing. That's such a cliche, but it was a little bit of that. I came from a military family that came from the South, basically, and their communication skills weren't maybe everything that I needed as a child. So at 10, I found myself shipped off from my parents. Well, I think my dad was going to Vietnam, and they were trying to figure all that out. So my brother's a year older, and were shipped off to my grandparents in Tucson, Arizona. And at the time, Tucson was not the swinging, sophisticated metropolis it is now. It was a kind of a dusty, beat-down little town. And I'd already discovered I liked to read, I found out that was actually more it was closer in resemblance to heroin than actually reading when I was in Tucson, because I felt really alone and dispossessed, and again, this Southern family, nobody talked about feelings. But I was riding my little 10-speed past a strip mall, and I wandered in. There was a little bookstore there. I thought, well, I've got a quarter. You know, I can find something to read. And my dad and I, one of the things we did when I was younger was we used to watch the old Johnny Weissmuller Tarzan movies. And my father had told me, you know, the guy who wrote it was named Edgar Rice Burroughs, and the books were much better because he had read them when he was a kid, too. So I'm wandering into this little dusty used bookstore, and some good soul had, sold this collection of Edgar Rice Burroughs books. I mean, there were a bunch of Tarzans, but there was also a Princess of Mars, and I don't know if it was Star Trek or what, but I said, oh, science fiction. So I turned over my quarter, and I got The Princess of Mars, which is the first book in like this 11-volume series that Burroughs wrote for his entire life, basically, in addition to Tarzan and everything else. But it was the book that actually made him a writer. So I took it back to the place where people don't talk, and I started reading it, this lonely 10-year-old kid. And when I came back from Mars about 6 hours later, because the book just completely transported me, it was the first one I had read that, for whatever reason, just took me somewhere else and made me somebody else. And when I put the book down after, you know, clutching it sweatily for 6 hours reading it, I said, this is magic. This is like real magic. It doesn't hurt anybody. And it's a magic I want to do. And I said, I'm going to be a writer.
Wow.
And that was it.
Wow, what a great story, Griff. And books really do. I mean, you know, good fiction can really just kind of transport you away and really take you on what I like to call sort of a mental and emotional vacation, where you just lose sight of everything around you and just become so engrossed in what you're reading. And that's what I love about fiction the most, I think. And that's cool. So where did you go from there? So you were 10 years old, so you made this decision. So how did you, I mean, obviously we have real life that gets in the way. So what kinds of jobs did you have to kind of take on as you were working on your goal of becoming a writer?
Well, I was an office boy at 15, just walked into some place and said, do you need an office boy? And they went, we hadn't thought about it, but why not? So, I've done all the usual stuff. Geez, I have been a waiter. I've been a janitor. I have worked in a bookstore. I've worked in warehouses. And then, you know, I did, you know, more mainstream jobs. I've been a substitute teacher. And then I was in the Coast Guard. And that was great. I got paid to be Errol Flynn. That was one of the real cool things about being a rescue swimmer, was I actually got paid to jump out of helicopters into the water and help people out, which was great. And, you know, I've also worked in the corporate world. And for 13 years I did IT work. But no matter what I was doing, I was writing. When I was on a Coast Guard patrol boat off in Virginia City, and in the middle of the night, after I'd done my the watches, you know, you walk around, make sure nothing's on fire and the boat's not sinking, and you have about 30 minutes to kill, I had an old Smith Corona typewriter, put it on my lap, and I'd just keep working on my play or whatever it was I was working on.
That's dedication. And that's great. I mean, I think...
Go ahead.
No, it's true. I'm glad we were talking about this, because I think a lot of times people, you know, sometimes as readers, I don't want to speak for everybody, but I feel like sometimes just readers in general, I think when you're when you become engrossed in a book and you're really enjoying it, you tend to forget how much work, in many cases years, go into the production of just one book. You know, the blood, sweat, and tears and all the kind of odd jobs you take on. And how cool to be able to jump out of helicopters in your case, though. That's awesome. But I think people tend to forget, you know, when they see a book like that, just how much effort really went into it.
I certainly didn't appreciate it. I mean, it's you see the magic, you don't see the sweat. You're right, definitely.
Yeah. So,
and the best books, in the best books, it's actually the magic's almost invisible. It just sort of envelops you. It's the bad books where you see, oh man, you know, they're really working hard to make this work and put it together,
yeah.
And it's really not smooth.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, and maybe we'll get into it a little bit. Maybe we could talk about how new technology has completely transformed the entire publishing industry and really created so many new opportunities. But before we do that, I want to ask you, now we're going to talk about The Big Bang, which is your latest book, but what other kinds of things had you written prior to that? Any success to speak of?
Oh, that's a funny story if it didn't happen to you. It was weird. For many years, I was almost good enough, and that got pretty maddening after a while. I was, I won a National Writing Award when I was 17, and then proceeded to like have nothing happen for a long time. I was like 25. When I was about 29 to 30, I was basically semi-finalist in the Playboy College Fiction Contest twice. But again, you know, I just sort of was almost there. Then I moved out to California and had an agent for a while, and that was, its own, ugly sitcom, but, wrote some screenplays. Was hired to write a television movie for Fox TV, and it was the complete and utter, screenwriter cliche story in that I finished it, you know, I did the work for about a year, and then about the time I turned in the third draft, they fired the particular VP at Fox and threw out all of his projects, including mine. And that was about the time I said, gosh, I guess I need to grow up and get a real job. And I'd actually gotten tired of screenplays at that point. I had some plays done. I did have some one-acts done back there. And again, same thing. I had some minor success just locally, but I had just enough feedback and approval, especially with live plays, because, you know, people aren't going to laugh at something that's not funny, and they aren't going to gasp at something that's not, you know, move them. So unless it's so bad, they can't believe they're there. But fortunately, I think at least my plays, that really helped. It really gave me a sense that what I was doing, even if not a lot of people saw it, at least the ones who did were really responding the way I hoped, and you know, kind of going on that emotional journey that I wanted them to see. But at a certain point, I just kind of got tired of screenplays because, for one thing, and by the way, I'm feeling a little lightheaded, so if I start going off to non sequiturs, reel me back in. One thing about writing a screenplay was, once you've finished it, you know, you mostly wrote it by yourself. You might have had some input from a manager or you know, someone who liked the idea. But then you turn it in, and you begin to suffer the death of a thousand cuts by MBAs. Now, these are not creative people. These are people who went to wherever it was, and they got their master's in business administration, and they'd come back and say things to you, hey, we need an Armenian girl in this. And, you know, it's a story about, like, puppies and ducks. And you're going, what? So I got tired of that. And so I just I stopped with the screenplays for a while. And I was working at a huge corporation, actually, running their PC help desk. And I just looked at it. I just got through it by telling myself, it's work as performance art. It was every day I got up and I put on a costume and I went and I performed for 8 or 9 hours, and then I could come home and be myself. And then I was still writing. I hadn't written any prose in a long time. And then I just started writing novels in the morning before I got up to go to work.
Amazing. And Griff, you know, you write such beautiful prose. I mean, I read book one in By the Hands of Men, and it's just so eloquent and beautiful. And then I kind of contrast that with what you were just saying about screenplays. And it seems like you write and you can write in so many different formats, but is there one that you favor over the other, and why?
Well, actually, I can't say that I do. I haven't written anything except novels in the past 3 or 4 years. You know, you kind of go where the success is, or at least the positive feedback. But what I discovered before that was I couldn't write in a particular genre. You know, I couldn't be Lee Child writing 20 Jack Reacher novels. As enjoyable as those are, that would, I think, bore me. And I would only write about whatever happened to interest me. So I wrote when I was in the Coast Guard in San Francisco, somebody asked me to write a children's story for like the Little Air Station newsletter. So I did that, and I really liked it, so I turned it into a children's play. And people loved that, and they said, hey, are you going to write children's stories? Well, no, because I sort of said what I had to write, said what I wanted to say with a children's story. And I think the next thing was something about, I think the next one was a vampire story, and that was a short story. So it just depends on what strikes me. And, you know, as you said, By the Hands of Men is an entirely different sort of world, and I even tried to write it in sort of the voice of the times, and the the mores and the ethos of the time, and then, you know, so there's very little colorful language in it, and it's almost has a archaic style, but that wouldn't work for something like The Big Bang, which is contemporary, and that just has a different kind of voice. So it just depends what catches my attention at the time. Once I finish the Three Lonesome George books, I have no idea what I'll do after that. I mean, I know I need to. I've got one more book to write to finish the By the Hands of Men series, but I don't know what I'm going to do after that. It just depends on what catches my attention and what I think is going to be the best way to tell the story. Maybe it would be a play, or maybe it'll be a screenplay.
Yeah, Griff, it's amazing that you're so versatile as a writer. That's fantastic, because I do know a lot of writers that tend to focus on one genre, and they're very good at it, but
right.
I think I might get bored. I mean, I'm kind of with you. I like that variety. That's fantastic.
And it makes it less like a job.
Yeah, and it's challenging.
You know, doing the same thing all the time.
Yeah, and I'm sure like each different type of genre or type of writing that you take on kind of challenges you in a different way and really enables you to grow as a writer.
I'd like to think so. Only the readers can say for sure.
Yeah. Now, Griff, you're now working. You're also a contributor to Liberty Island, which is known as the home of the new conservative counterculture. And you kind of alluded to this earlier, but I want to ask you, have you always thought of yourself as a quote-unquote conservative?
No. I mentioned my father. He was from the South, and he was born in 1940, and he was smart enough to look around. He lived in a little town called Stark, Florida, and he told me once that was the absolutely perfect description of the town. And he looked around and said, "Wow, this is no future for me." So he got his mom to sign for him so he could join the Air Force before he was 18. To basically get the hell out of Stark, Florida. And he, like I said, was a smart guy. He's a really sensitive guy, but he won't let you know that. He wanted to leave the ignorance, the poverty, and the racism behind, because I think he was smart enough, and he also had the experience. I got to do a side note here. You know, it's clearly there was a lot of racism he was raised with, and you know, I remember clearly my grandfather saying, you know, horrible racist things, but I mean, he was born in like 1910 or something, so that was just where he was from, And my dad wanted to leave that behind. So he and at the time, I think the Air Force was changing, so it exposed him to a lot of new things. And I think one of the best ways, in my own experience and also from some things I've read, to change people's minds about other groups of people are to put them in proximity.
Mm-hmm.
That happened a lot in World War II during the island hopping in the Pacific at Pilau. The Marines were pinned down. It was a guy wrote a great book about it called With the Old Breed. It's a book every high school student should read, but I can't make that happen. But you know, they were pinned down in these horrific, ghastly conditions, and they were on the line, you know, with maggots in the mud all around them. Their clothes are rotting off of them. They're just getting beat all to hell. But they were the white soldiers, and black Marines were only used for things like stretcher bearers, you know, corpse retrieval, porters almost. And the black Marines said to the Marines, "Hey, let us relieve those poor bastards." And somebody had the sense to go, "Yeah, they can hold a rifle. Let them go up in the foxhole." And that's the kind of thing that then people get a whole different experience of another group, another race, another sex, whatever it is. You get to see them outside of your preconceptions. Well, anyway, that happened to my dad. So my dad raised my brother and I as classical liberals in every, you know, equality. You know, people are equal, you know, and you treat people the way you want to be treated. All that classic liberal stuff. And so I thought of myself as a liberal up until I was about 28. And in fact, I would probably still be a liberal today if I'd never met any. I actually married a person of a liberal persuasion, and boy, was that an education. Because I got to see how people who called themselves liberal, they weren't. They just weren't. You know, the term liberal did not mean what it meant to me when I was growing up. You know, they were very big into all the things we all know. You know, we've all experienced, at least, you know, there's a good group of people and then there's the bad group of people. Isn't, you know, there's just people. It's, oh no, you know, you're the evil white guy, and this is the saintly minority female or whatever it is. But and also, you know, you see all, what's that?
I said member of the patriarchy.
All that stuff. And you went, wait a minute, I thought generalizations about groups were bad, so why are you telling me that all men want younger women? I mean, that's a generalization. Isn't that bad? And, you know, just that sort of thing. And so,
yeah.
Anyway, it was just, I think it was experiencing the huge disconnect between what they said they believed and what they actually believed that made me say, you know, I'm not a liberal, you know. I'm a conservative because I would see more, I experienced more of those classical liberal beliefs among people who call themselves conservatives. So it was a progression.
Well, that's a great story.
Yeah, and it's just.
Okay.
I was saying it's just more like just changing the label because my beliefs are essentially the same. You know, when I was when I worked at the corporate location, I discovered that Dilbert is prophecy. You know, Scott Adams is the oracle of our age because everything he says is true. But
yeah.
I didn't care, and it's going to sound like a joke, but when I became the supervisor of this help desk and I needed to hire some temps, the first temp person I hired was a black kid in a wheelchair. And I did it simply because he could do the job I needed. He was the best guy. I needed somebody who was good on the phone, articulate. He could do it. And
mm-hmm.
That was the only reason I hired him. And during my tenure, I hired black people, Mexican-American guys, Asian. I didn't care if they could do the job. That was all I cared about. Can you do the job? Are you a decent person? You show up on time? Can we count on you? All that stuff. You know, the rest of it, I don't care. I don't, you know, be who you are. Just come here, do the job, have a nice day. And to me, that's, you know, that's what it comes down to. I think that's what most conservatives, I would suggest, really want. You know, you pay your taxes, you obey the law. Okay, fine. Hey, glad to have you.
Yes, exactly, and that's certainly been my experience. And you know, and you're right that when you mentioned earlier, like one of the things we've been combating, and actually when we get back from the break, we'll talk about the importance of culture and good storytelling and the conservative libertarian fiction effort when we come back after the break, because for way too long the narrative, if I'm going to use that word, has been that, you know, conservatives, and you said this earlier, you know, are just all these buttoned up, humorless, you know, racist, homophobic, you know, fill in the horrible adjective of your choice. And that's been the myth that's been perpetuated in our culture. And it's been so incredibly damaging. And so I definitely want to delve into more of that, Griff, when we come back. And I also want to get to talking about Lonesome George, because it's gotten some wonderful reviews. And I want to talk about what you've got coming up here as far as future books. So let's just go ahead and take a quick break here. We'll play a couple of commercials, and then we'll pick right up when we come back.
All right.
Thanks.
Great.
Hi, I'm Diane.
And this is Denise.
And we want to invite you to listen to the History Goes Bump podcast.
Ghost tours for the theater of the mind.
The History Goes Bump podcast. A show featuring a look at historic locations, people, and events with a twist. This history podcast is haunted. So grab your slippers, hot chocolate, flashlight, and maybe even that baseball bat, and join us.
You can find the show at iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other various podcast catchers.
Check out the website at historygoesbump.com.
Keep it spooky.
Monday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the Right Stream Radio Network. Tune in to Military Monday with host John D. Gresham, author, military historian, and journalist. John delves into a unique aspect of U.S. military history, as well as current events and issues affecting our men and women in uniform. Featuring exceptional guests, military experts, and authors, Military Monday with John D. Gresham entertains, informs, and encourages listeners to support those who put it all on the line for freedom. Military Monday with John D. Gresham. Monday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the Right Stream Radio Network.
The Speculative Fiction Cantina is your weekly hypodermic injection of science fiction, fantasy, horror, alternate history, and things weird and wonderful in the world of books and writers. You'll hear from writers who bend the rules and drive the narrative. We ask authors the hard questions. We do the show in our pajamas. Join S. Evan Townsend on this journey over the rainbow and through the looking glass. The Speculative Fiction Cantina. On Right Stream Radio every Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern.
In a moment, cancer changed our lives forever.
We were told nothing could be done to enjoy these final moments together.
But in that moment, when all seemed lost, St. Jude Children's Research Hospital gave us hope.
Because at this moment, St. Jude Children's Research Hospital is saving lives with pioneering research and care. We're changing the way the world treats childhood cancer by sharing our discoveries with doctors and scientists everywhere.
And we'll never have to pay St. Jude for anything, ever.
At this moment, she wants to be in her own bed.
I want to be back at school with my friends.
I want to be outside playing.
Please take a moment and join St. Jude in finding cures and saving children. Visit stjude.org.
You're listening to the Right Stream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter @RightStream. #RightStream. Thanks for listening to the Right Stream Radio Network.
Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to Right Stream Tuesday with Daria Ann, yours truly here, your host, and my guest this evening, Roy M. Griffiths. Welcome back, Griff.
Hey, I'm there. How do I sound? I moved my headphone.
You sound good.
Okay, great.
I only have a cold, but you still sound good.
So, and I look even better.
Good thing it's radio, right? You see, I wouldn't even describe how I look right now. the wonders of the internet, I'll tell you.
Yes.
But Griff, before we went to break, we were talking a little bit about your journey to becoming a conservative, and we kind of touched upon the culture. So I want to ask you, why is culture so important in your opinion, and how does fiction sort of play into all of that?
Well, that's a. Can you give us an extra hour? Because I think we're going to really dig into that. But briefly, I'll tell you what I think is briefly. I believe it starts with us as human beings. If we look closely at our lives, and I'm gonna, if I begin to like wax pompous here, I'm gonna blame it on the cold. But I believe that we all have a story we tell ourselves about the world. I think that's actually how we make sense of our lives, our place in the universe. Everything is we have a story. And if your personal story is I'm a victim of circumstance, that's a really different story than I can take any damn thing they throw at me. And
mm-hmm.
So I believe, and that was certainly part of the reason I went to the Coast Guard and became a rescue swimmer, is I wanted to change the story I told myself, and it worked in my case. So I believe that if you change your story, you can change your life. And if we look at when we say culture, it's not just one thing. It isn't just our way of government. It's the media that's all around us that sort of saturates the environment. It's, we're like the fish in the water. We're not aware of the water sort of thing. Well, it's the water all around us. And if the water is poisoned with a story, conservatives are bad, you need, it's government that's going to take care of you, and you can't fight against capitalism. You can't fight against whatever. It's the government's going to take care of you. And sort of a part of that is, like I said, conservatives are bad, they're mean, they're homophobic, they're closed-minded, and all this stuff. That's the story that the people who have taken over the media, which I think is in a lot of ways creating the reality of our time, that's the story they tell mostly. It's, mm-hmm. In the Middle Ages, they had the Catholic Church who had a certain story. You have to buy indulgences to get your people out of purgatory and all that sort of thing. So people took that as reality, right? Well, the corrupt secular religion right now is the people like John Stuart, who he'd be the if he's not the Pope, he's the Archbishop of this corrupt secular religion, which continues to tell the story that if you believe in the Constitution, if you believe in the explicit rights that are in the Constitution, such as the Second Amendment, those are the bad people. People who believe in those things are bad, and people who are pro-life are bad. Anyway, so you ask why stories are important. Well, I think it's important because it's up to us to change the story that Americans and perhaps the world are being told. We continue. The story is that the more socialist forms of government are great. They're wonderful. As long as you overlook the 70 million people Mao killed in famines, the 35 million that Stalin killed by forced relocations, you sort of gloss over those little speed bumps on the road to paradise, and they don't mention that when they talk about you know, let's do these wonderful collective things. Let's have a centralized government. It's going to be great. And anybody who resists it, why, you know, those Tea Party guys, they're terrorists and all that stuff. And I think I'm babbling. Please stop me. But
you're right. Yeah.
I think stories are important because we need to change the story that is being told.
Yeah.
And it was great. And, you know, that was one of the cool things about being in New York, was seeing some young folks who recognized the story they were being told was nonsense. That it was disconnected from objective reality. It was a fairy tale, and they were recognizing it, and that was heartening. So why tell stories? First, because that's how we make sense of the world, and second, because I think it's important to change the story that is being told over and over and over by Hollywood and the press and all those people who manage to find excuses when Bill Clinton is a serial sexual predator, and yet he's the keynote speaker at the Democratic convention where they've been spending all their time shrieking about the Republican war on women,
and booing God,
and you know Bill Clinton's your basic ninja against women, but they invite him in. So, so there you go.
Yeah, it's
I hope
very
that made sense to our listeners.
Yeah, no, well, it made perfect sense to me, and I'm sure that it did. I mean, it makes me. You're right. We would need like another 3 hours. It just makes me want to pull my hair out. But I'm going to take a positive approach here and talk about some of the things that you are involved in that are helping to sort of counteract this narrative, because now we are the counterculture as, you know, conservative libertarians who actually love our country, our freedom, and our individuality. So, Griff, tell us how you ended up working with Liberty Island.
Complete fluke. I had actually written the first draft of The Big Bang, maybe in 2008. I was very angry with the way the press was portraying the war in Iraq, and just infuriated by their slanders of George W. Bush. You know, when on one hand they didn't want to show these people leaping out of the Twin Towers, who chose to fall to their death rather than burn to death, because showing that would inflame Americans against Muslims. Yet as soon as they decided it was a bad thing for us to be in the Middle East, the same press went to court to make sure they could show every damn body bag that came back from the Middle East,
mm-hmm.
because they just wanted to bludgeon a Republican president. And for whatever reason, I find a lack of principle infuriating. It's fine if you think, yeah, you know, war in the Middle East is bad. Well, then it has to be bad under Barack Obama as well as it is under George W. Bush. And so I was actually going to try to write a nonfiction work just trying to tell the stories that weren't being told about the successes. And I'd actually contracted General Petraeus's office and people like that. And the question they kept giving me was, hey, this is a great idea. We'd love to help you. Are you a credentialed journalist? And it's like, no. I'm a guy who just wants to write. And I couldn't write this nonfiction, so I wrote it as fiction. And then I just wrote it for myself. I hadn't written a novel, and I wrote it, and I had a good time, and I kind of set it aside. And then one day I was reading Instapundit, and he had a little blurb about a new conservative magazine that was starting up. And here was their address for submissions. And I thought, well, what the hell? And I sent them a short story, and I sent them the first chapter of Lonesome George. And pretty much after about 4 months, they wrote back and said, so, you thought about a sequel? And I just sort of had in passing, and I gave them my notes. And then they said, yeah, we'd like to publish your novel. I went, cool.
Awesome.
Yeah. And, yeah, so it was absolutely just a fluke. And it was also just part of my whole journey as a human being, where I realized never give up is kind of my thing. You know, I would much rather die having tried than wishing I'd tried. And so
oh, yeah.
I figured
that, yeah.
pretty much my thing is, what can I lose? So I sent them an email, and it went from there.
Well, you know, there's a saying, Griff, it's something about, you know, regrets for the things you did not do can be tempered over time, but regret for the things you didn't, regret for the things you did can be tempered over time, but regret for the things you did not do just never goes away, or something like that. I'm paraphrasing, but I think that's so true.
Right. Absolutely. Right. I agree with that. And that's what I've done. Is I just figure, what can I lose? You know, they can't kill me.
Inspiring.
And then I did.
Hey, Griff, before we get to the next question here, because I definitely want to talk about Lonesome George. I keep saying that, but we have a caller on the line. I suspect I may know who this is, if I recognize the number, but it will be a surprise for both of us since I don't have a producer tonight. So, you up for a caller?
Yes, ma'am. Sure.
All right. Here we go. Okay. Caller from 910, you're on the air.
Hi, Daria. This is Jack.
Hey, Jack. How are you?
Is this Jack of Amy Lynn fame?
This is me, yes. Yes.
Awesome.
I was sitting here listening to your pedigree, just jealous as all get out. Oh, my goodness, do you have a pass? That's outstanding.
Well, in some cases it's checkered, but yeah, and grace of God and all that sort of thing.
It's that all of us. I was curious about two things. One, we talk about writing conservative books. Do you think should we go after writing conservative books on purpose, or are we better off being conservatives and writing books? Because I always thought that people who wrote books, you could pretty much tell a lot about them. Their politics, their attitudes, their ideals bleed through in their writing, whether it means to or not.
Well, I would agree with you absolutely with the second contention that, you know, we just have to write a good story. I think if you start out with, by golly, I'm going to write this story about how awful feminists are, it turns into propaganda and it's going to be dull. And I think it's much better to simply write the story, and you're right. I believe who we are will tend to come through. I don't know about you guys, but I was talking about the culture earlier, but my wife and I, pretty much my automatic tip-off of lazy, bad writing is when they introduce the villain who's, the conservative Christian or
white
the stay-at-home
male.
Mom. Yeah, the white male, it's like, oh, come on, for Pete's sake, give me something new. And so we just got to the point where we turn it off. As soon as they, you try to give them a chance, like, well, maybe they won't be lazy this time. But anyway, yeah, I agree with you. I think we just write a good story. Write a good story, and the problem was some of these good stories may have, in fact, had a sort of conservative bent, and it didn't check off the boxes that all the cool kids, were checking off. We weren't the particular flavor of the month, or we may have suggested, in fact, that some of the things the cool kids believe might be wrong. They might not work, and the cool kids don't want to see that. So that was, I think that's one reason a lot of conservative-leaning writers were sort of shut out.
Interesting. I have one more question, and then we'll go
on
to talk about your book that I'm looking forward to reading very much.
Cool.
And I want to talk about something extremely boring for people that don't write books. But I want to talk about your mechanics, because apparently you have a lot of experience. And I want to know, I hear so much stuff about how people write. People talk about putting post-it notes on their walls with little arrows of this scene going into this scene, and some use 3x5 cards. And what works for you? What is your process like when you write?
All right. Well, okay. It actually depends on what I'm writing. Screenplays and plays actually, because the finished product is actually so structured, I found out I had to actually do a 20-page single-spaced short story that I would write that. And that's the way I could work out all my little changes and my whatevers. And then I would take that and essentially transpose it into the format. I've discovered when I write a novel, it's a lot more free-flowing by the hands of men. Daria may not know this, but I had one idea 30 years ago. I said, well, that's interesting. I can't do anything with that. Then about 10 years after that, I had another idea. And they were both floating out there until one day they lined up, and I said, wow, one part's the beginning and one part's the end. So when I'm writing a novel, I know where I'm starting and I know where it's going to end up, but how I get there, it just sort of comes to me as I write. And, you know, the one mechanic I would encourage anybody to do is make it a habit. I think I mentioned that I would get up at 4 in the morning to write for a couple of hours before I had to get ready for work. And, yeah, it was tough at first, but at a certain point, you just sort of train yourself. And what it also does is, so you do the work in the morning, but then the rest of the day, your mind's kind of working, your subconscious is in the back there, digging through the files, and it's almost like my attention became magnetized. So things would come to me, and I might write something down. I go, oh, yeah, I had that idea while I was in the shower, so I'll just write that down, because I know that will feed off something I've already written, and it solves a problem. And again, it just becomes sort of another signpost on the journey. So my mechanics for a novel are I just know where I'm going, and how I get there is sort of a surprise to me as well.
Outstanding. Well, thank you very much. And Daria, good show as usual. Griff, it was nice talking to you. And
well, Jack,
let's talk about your book.
All right, Jack. Thanks for calling in, buddy.
All right.
Thanks,
have a good
Jack.
One. Bye, Daria.
Okay.
Take
All
care.
Right. Bye.
Bye. All right, so Griff, I do want to talk about Lonesome George. My goodness, you have gotten some fabulous reviews from some conservative heavy hitters like Rich Lowry and Ben Shapiro, these prominent conservative journalists and authors. And I think Lowry called it a wild romp through a post-apocalyptic America, unimaginably awful, but also highly contemporary. And Shapiro calls your book clever, witty, tense, and a thoroughly enjoyable read. So I can't wait to read it myself, but gosh, I mean, I don't know where we left off when we had our caller, but that's got to make you feel incredible to receive reviews like that.
It really is. It was very gratifying. I've got some feedback. Can you hear that?
I can. I can hear you fine, but...
Okay, great. Don't worry about it.
Oh, sorry. Blog Talk Radio again.
God bless them. So yes, it's great. The book came out on Audible as an audio book, and that was unexpected as well, because I guess they don't do every book as an audio book. They happened to, you know, they had an option, and somebody checked out the book and said, yeah, I think we can make a few bucks on this. So that's like almost the highest praise. If somebody's going to put their money where your mouth is, you know, that's awesome.
Fantastic. So that's out already? The audio?
Yes, ma'am. That,
wow.
On audible.com. And I've just finished listening to it, and it's kind of fun to do that, too.
Now, did they hire someone, Griff, to read the book?
Yeah,
to record?
There's a professional New York. They have a stable of people, and this guy was a professional New York actor. His name's James Fooey, and he's done some other books, and he did a nice job. I was very pleased with it.
Very cool. And the book, I know, is also available on Amazon, of course, in Kindle and in paperback, correct?
Right. Oh, gosh, it's available from the Nook. It's on iTunes, both as an ebook and an audiobook. You can find it in a lot of places.
Excellent. And this might be a good time, Griff, to give out your website, too, and let people know where they can find you out there in cyberspace.
Sure. Well, I have a author's page on Amazon, which I think is linked to the book, but you look me up under Roy M. Griffiths. And by coincidence, that's the name of my website, Roy M. Griffiths, that's I-S, as in Sam, RoyMGriffiths.com. And that's where most of my novel-related stuff happens. And then, of course, you can also find me, a version of me, over at therightwingriot.com, where we post the newest Truesberry 3 times a week.
Fantastic. So, Griff, what are you working on now?
I am finishing the sequel to Lonesome George. For shorthand, it's LG2. I'm not sure what the title is going to be just yet. I'm about 50 pages from being done with that. It looks like it's going to be about twice as long as Lonesome George. I introduced some new characters. And my wife tells me it's better than the last one, and who am I to doubt her? And as soon as I finish that, I will be working on editing and revising books 2 and 3 of the By the Hands of Men series while I start writing book 4 of By the Hands of Men. So I'm actually looking forward to finishing Lonesome George 2 so I can get back to By the Hands of Men, because that's a fun series for me, and I enjoy the world a lot too.
Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to that also. Fantastic. So, Griff, you're a busy guy, very proud of all of your accomplishments. And I almost hate to ask this question because you're already doing so much, but what else would you like to do as a creative person?
You know, I've got to be honest. I was doing a radio show before life mugged me.
I seem to remember that.
What's that?
I seem to remember that. No.
You do, yes. I would kind of like to start doing that again once we figure out when we can get all the moving parts together. Honestly, I don't know. Like I said, I just kind of write what catches my attention. And in this case, it's been a couple of long novel series. Gosh, the books 2 and 3 of By the Hands of Men ran 1,000 pages total. And, I just don't know. I mean, it might be fun to do another play. I hear that they're looking for a conservative John Stewart. That might be a fun gig to try out for. A real conservative, not a Stephen Colbert type conservative. I'm open. You know, it's almost going to be more a matter of what opportunity presents itself and what I think I can do well. You know, I have enough ego that if I do something, I want to do it well. And it could be a film, could be a play, could be more novels. It's I don't know.
Well, I certainly look forward to seeing where that road takes you. And before I let you go, Griff, and I really appreciate you hanging in there because with your cold, and I know it can be tough having to do a long interview. But before I let you go, I just wanted to ask you, though, because Jack kind of alluded to this a little bit, but what advice do you have for aspiring writers out there? Now that we do have, you know, new technology and we have a way to get beyond the gatekeepers, but what are some rules that you think or just guidelines that perhaps they should follow if they really want to put their best work out there?
Well, the first thing is something the old Hollywood screenwriter said, and that's the seat of the pants to the seat of the chair. Don't talk about your writing. Sit down. Do it. Then write something, write what's honest and true for you. Don't write for what you imagine the market is, because the market changes, and by the time you write for that trend or that hot topic, it'll be old and cold. I think you're better off writing what you really believe, a story you want to tell, and a story you think is important. Then after that happens, maybe find a writer's group or maybe just one individual who can help you, because we all need editors. You know, our brains just stop seeing stuff at a certain point. We need that outside, more objective eye. I would choose that person carefully. You don't want somebody who's like an embittered failure who, you know, is going to make sure nobody else tries to do what they didn't have the courage to do themselves. And then consider your options. Then you email me or Daria, and we give you some suggestions. But there's certainly things like Create Space, where you can self-publish your own work. You can self-publish your own Kindles, again, through Create Space. The last part of that is that the biggest problem with those venues is marketing, is getting the word out that your product exists, getting people to read it, and getting good word of mouth. But first, you got to sit down. You got to write something that's honest and true. Even if it's fiction, I tell people I lie for a living, but I still try to make it as emotionally honest and authentic as I can. And that means I have to eschew the easy liberal bashing that might leap to my lips in less thoughtful times. Because that's just what the other guys do. You know, that's just lazy. Yeah. and it's a cheat.
Yeah.
But that's the first thing you got to do. You got to sit down, you got to write it, and it's got to kind of come from your heart. It's got to come from an authentic place, even if it's fiction.
I so agree with that. And, you know, even as a ghostwriter, I don't take on every project that comes my way. I have to have at least 80% buy-in, and I have to have a certain amount, I have to have a certain level of respect for the person and what they're trying to do, even though it's not my book, because you're right. I mean, it's sort of like paradoxical, but even as a ghostwriter, you have to throw your heart into it, even though technically it's not your book. And if my heart isn't in what somebody else's concept, I'll tell them, look, I don't want to take your money because I just can't do it. I'm not the right person for this job. So I so agree with that, Griff. I really do. And I just, you know, is there anything else you'd like to let our listeners know before we sign off tonight?
Let's see. Flossing is apparently the secret to long life, if you didn't know that. No, I would just say, you know, if you're tired of reading stuff that insults you for holding a certain set of values and a certain set of views, and the stuff, if you're tired of reading stuff that insults you without even realizing it's an insult, go look for places like Liberty Island. If you go look at my book or Frank Fleming's book on Amazon, it'll give you that thing, people who bought this also bought these. That'll lead you to other conservative authors. I mean, I have not read Jack's book, Amy Lynn, but I've heard people say it's fantastic. You know, if you really want to read good stories that aren't lazy and aren't dismissive of you and your values, email me, email Daria, heck, email Liberty Island. And we'll be glad to start giving you some titles of the good stuff we know is out there that you didn't know. And
yeah.
I think there is a hunger for those kinds of stories.
Oh, I definitely agree. And they could also request to join the Conservative Libertarian Fiction Alliance on Facebook and actually interact with these wonderful authors.
This is true. What do we have? How many people do we have in that now?
Gosh. 700?
I was
going
to say 4,000. Yeah, we have a bunch of folks now.
We have a lot of people.
Yeah, they're out there.
Yeah, I love that. And I just have to say, it is as a reader, I mean, it's wonderful because it has opened up a whole new world. I mean, I had really stopped reading fiction because I was just tired of books that just insulted me. But as you were saying, like for my values and morals, it's the same reason why I stopped reading quote-unquote women's magazines like 2 decades ago, because I thought, I see my point of view represented, and when it is, it's always to mock and ridicule it rather than to just present it as,
yes,
you know, values that some women hold, or I would even submit most women hold. But that's not what Cosmo's all about, apparently. So.
No. It's a niche market, but, you know, it has a name brand, and we just need to change that.
Yeah.
And if any of the minions of the evil Koch brothers are listening, give money to Liberty Island. You know, we'd be glad to put out some newspapers and some magazines to compete with the poisonous swill that is out there right now.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, reach into those pockets, the people who, you know, on our side who have those deep pockets. That's a great appeal. Maybe I'll see if I can send this podcast to them when we're done, Griff.
Feel free.
But anyway, I want to thank you so much for joining me tonight. It's been a real pleasure as always, and much success to you in your future writing endeavors and with Lonesome George. I can't wait to read it when I finally do get a chance to read for pleasure again, which I hope is going to be soon. I will be posting reviews on Amazon, and just encourage everyone to please check Griff out on Amazon.com and all your future work. Like I said, By the Hands of Men, just so beautifully written. I just love that book. So, ladies and gentlemen, we've got quality authors out there, like Roy M. Griffith. So that's another thing. Like, support these talented people who are really pouring their heart and soul into creating books of value and entertaining books. So.
Well, gosh, Gloria, thank you very much. And I'm glad you enjoyed the book. That means a lot to me that somebody I don't know just would read the book. And just thanks for having me on today. It's been fun.
All right. Well, you're welcome. Well, I hope you feel better soon, Griff.
All right. I'll talk to you later.
All right. Have a good night. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was Roy M. Griffiths. Check him out at roymgriffiths.com, libertyislandmagazine.com, and rightwingriot.com. Just a little programming note, next week we will be back to our 1 p.m. Eastern broadcast time with author Daniela Bova, who has just released the second book in her series, Storms of Transformation, called The Notice. So I'm very looking forward to interviewing Daniela about that next week, and I hope you will tune in for that. Tomorrow night, Fantasy Dating Radio with Suzanne and Rob. They are going to have dating coach Michelle Bianco on the show, and apparently she's a character, and I've heard some rumors about some kind of a meatball bake-off or something. I don't know. They've got some kind of competition going on with who can cook the better-tasting meatballs, something like that. So you don't want to miss that tomorrow night at 9 p.m. Eastern. Suze and Rob, always, it's always a good time with them. And so learn to play the game of love with Fantasy Dating Radio. And then Lisa and I will be back here Thursday night for Love, Liberty, and Lip Gloss with Michelle Hasty Thompson, talking about her book, The Weight Loss Shift. And then Friday, the Speculative Fiction Cantina goes live with author S. Evan Townsend at 6 p.m., and we start the weekend with Get Fit, Feel Fabulous with Brit. I believe she's going to be talking with an acupuncture specialist this Saturday at 10 a.m. Eastern, so you don't want to miss that. And then back to Sunday, Just Believe with Lisa Tarvis at 7 p.m. Eastern, and she will have a talented psychic offering free readings on the air. And then Monday, we'll be back to Military Monday with John D. Gresham at 1 p.m. Eastern. Again, a special shout-out to my good buddy Snapperhead. Thank you so much for all the work you're doing on our rightstreamradio.com website. Really looking forward to that. Check out The American Journal, the-american-journal.com, where I'm also a contributor, along with Declan Finn and other members of the Conservative Libertarian Fiction Alliance. Actually, my latest post about Sarah Palin, who is a woman who really knows how to engage the culture. If anyone knows the importance of culture, it's Sarah Palin. And I wish some of my fellow conservatives would understand that, those who have been sort of dismissing her for attending the 40th anniversary of Saturday Night Live. But anyway, you can check out my latest post about that at The American Journal. And check out all the writers there as well. It's a great site. And I think that's going to wrap it up for me tonight. Again, I'll be back on the airwaves Thursday for Love, Liberty, and Lip Gloss with Lisa Tarvis, my co-host, and back here for Rightstream Tuesday next week at 1 p.m. Eastern with author Daniela Bova. Until then, everybody, God bless you all, and God bless America. The twilight.